You're in a good place now. You are listening to Perspectives with Ashley Burgess.
Welcome back live to Live Your True Life Perspectives, and I'm your host, Ashley Burgess. Tonight we're talking with somebody that I am very interested to hear about his background, his knowledge, his wisdom, but better yet, he's written a book. He's about to write another book. He's actually in the process of publishing a second book, but we're going to talk about this first book tonight. Roy L. Hill joins the Live Your True Life Perspectives, and he recently wrote Psychology and the Near-Death Experience, Searching for God. Roy, thank you so much for joining us on Live Your True Life Perspectives. It's amazing to have you here on the air.
Thank you, Ashley. It's a great honor to be here with you today.
So tell me. I mean, I've always been interested in this stuff, and I definitely believe in this stuff. Let's put that out there. Tell me a little background information about you, because I think that our listeners need to know where you're coming from and maybe how this all kind of came about.
Well, Ashley, I started off in a very scientific household. My father's a physicist, as well as my brother, and my mother's a geologist. We did attend Baptist Church, traditional Christian background. And that's basically the way I saw the world, from a very scientific point of view, with some sort of side beliefs of, well, there's a God, and I'll accept the traditional Christian view. But I didn't have a strong connection, I think, with the divine. All that really changed about 16 years ago. I'm a psychologist by profession. I worked for the Federal Bureau of Prisons for 20 years. And in that capacity, I ran sex offender programs, drug programs, and forensic programs for federal court, things of that nature. So 16 years ago, I was actually working more as a staff psychologist, and I had an inmate whose sister had passed away. And this inmate I knew was fragile, and so I talked to him, and indeed, he was not doing well. In fact, he was suicidal, so I had to put him on suicide watch. So the first day, no change, but the second day, the inmate says, oh, I'm better, I'm ready to come off watch. And I'm thinking, as a psychologist, I wonder why now? Why the sudden change? It was very skeptical, of course.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah, so I asked him, why the change? He goes, well, my deceased sister is talking to me, and she is telling me that I should not be here on suicide watch worrying about her because she's in a better place. She's just fine. That I had my own mission, my own things that I needed to do, that I needed to move on, get off watch, and get on with what I needed to do in my life. So I thought about that. You know, the first thing as a psychologist would be hearing voices, psychotic perhaps. But a part of me said, no, you know, all the people who have been schizophrenic and, or otherwise psychotic for other reasons, when they hear voices, they're never helpful. They're negative, they're cryptic, they're shallow in its content. And this was completely opposite. So I thought, well, I'm going to take this guy off watch as long as the officers look at him during the night, and I'll talk to him first thing in the morning. Indeed, his mental status looked good. He was eating well, looked animated, all this stuff. So the next morning, I talked to him. And I asked him, is your sister still talking to you? And he said, yes. I said, well, what is she telling you? He said, she's telling me you don't believe me. And because you don't believe, she has a message. Well, coming from my Christian background, I've never come across this sort of thing before. And so, you know, my getting goosebumps on my arms and the hairs are standing up. And then I asked him, well, what's her message? He said, quarter. I said, quarter? What does that mean? Like quarter of something or quarter the coin? And he said, well, I'm not so sure. Let me ask her. And he comes back, says, quarter. She says, quarter the coin. So what does that mean? And he says, I don't know. She won't tell me.
Huh.
So he leaves, and another inmate comes in. This guy is a white Muslim, which is a whole different type of inmate. Wasn't running around with the first inmate at all. And so he was kind of ranting about the hypocrisy of the United States. And I was half listening when he said, Dr. Hill, you know what's written on the quarter? Uh-huh. I said, in God we trust. I said, wow.
Wow.
You know, nobody has asked that from me before or since. So the timing had a synchronicity to it that just couldn't be ignored. So, of course, I talked to the first guy right away, told him what happened. He seemed surprised. And I asked him, is there anything else your sister's telling you? And he said, well, she's telling me that your wife is pregnant, you're going to have a son, and he will be born on Christmas Day.
Oh, wow.
So, well, that's really specific. And I knew the first two to be true. But could he have known that? Possibly. Very doubtful, because staff were not supposed to be talking about this in front of other inmates. But perhaps he overheard something. So really the true test was whether my son was going to be born on Christmas Day. Well, he was born January 7th. Hmm. So go forward another 11 years. I'm here in Colorado in another institution. I'm working at night, walking back to my department, and just kind of upset about all this. You know, I had been bothering me for a while. You know, all that first stuff seemed true. But here he was not born on Christmas Day. So I had an epiphany. First, there was a declaration that I didn't have faith. Then there was this directive that I needed to trust in God. Maybe this was a test of faith. So in a leap of faith, knowing full well, as everybody does, Christmas Day is December 25th, I Googled January 7th and Christmas Day. And lo and behold, a lot of stuff came up. It turns out that we use the Roman calendar or the Julian calendar. But prior to that, the Christians used the Christian calendar or the Gregorian calendar. And still to this day, the Russian Orthodox, the Greek Orthodox, half a billion Orthodox Christians use the Gregorian calendar. And according to this Gregorian Christian calendar, Christmas Day is January 7th.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So I thought to myself, this is incredible. And it wasn't to teach me that Christmas Day could be January 7th. This was a lesson in learning to have faith, and also a lesson to broaden my spiritual horizons to consider so many other things. So what I did was I tried to investigate. Why me? Why am I getting this stuff? What am I supposed to do with it? I talked to some of my Christian friends. They said, well, Doc, you know what this is? This is probably from the devil. You got to be careful. I knew that wasn't the case, because the message from the devil wouldn't be to trust in God. So in response, I turned to near-death experiences, which I had read Raymond Moody's book. And then after that, I had discovered the NDERF website, which is Near Death Experience Research Foundation, where at the time there was over 3,000 anonymous NDE accounts. And as I read those accounts, a whole new spiritual understanding or awareness came to me. It was like doing this big spiritual puzzle, and I was putting all the pieces in, and all the pieces fit. And it was amazing. So in any case, as I discovered more and more and things fit and fit, I started corresponding with the website's owners, the Longs. And they encouraged me to write a book, and I did. And that's how I came about doing what I'm doing.
That's some amazing stuff. We have to go to break here in a second, but this is interesting. I mean, it's funny. When I was a kid, I remember my father telling me about the real Christmas. And you know, I remember him telling me Little Christmas, that's what they called it. So they called it Little Christmas, and that's what they celebrated when they were when he was a young kid. And that's interesting because a lot of times, you know, it's like you had to sit there and step back and kind of listen to that and allow that man to tell you that. And I think oftentimes some people don't want to do that or they're too scared to do that. And that was pretty profound that you allowed that to be.
Yes, I certainly had a predisposition to be open for whatever reason. And I had always been opening and questioning as a kid, going to the churches, even though I accepted the basic doctrine, I was in the back of my mind questioned certain things. So I think that openness allowed me to be a vessel for God to work through and continues to work through today.
That's awesome. When we return, Roy's going to be telling us more about his book, Psychology and the Near-Death Experience, more about near-death experiences and what they mean, and some of the accounts of the people that he writes about in the book. I'm looking forward to hearing more about that. And stay tuned, because Live Your True Life Perspectives with your host, me, Ashley Burgess, will be back this time in, be back this time in two shakes.
Up and jump in the deep end on Perspectives. Now, here's Ashley.
Welcome back live to Live Your True Life Perspectives, and I'm your host, Ashley Burgess. Tonight we have a special gift. We have Roy Hill joining us. Roy, besides the fact of being a psychiatrist, but a psychologist, and written the book, The Psychology and the Near-Death Experience, it's really amazing because if you missed the first segment earlier, Roy was giving the background of how this book came to be, how this philosophy came to be. And, you know, and it begins with opening your mind and allowing things that maybe we don't always feel is completely, I guess, what we're used to. And sometimes we have to open our mind to maybe possibly a new perspective. Roy, so let's talk. I think that story was amazing. Let's talk about, right before the break, we were talking about how you got involved with the Near-Death Experience Research Foundation and how you began to communicate with some of the folks that had near-death experiences. And I know that you kind of you adapt some of those into your book. Tell us more about that, and also tell us more about maybe your definition of what you consider an NDE or a near-death experience.
Well, in reading all these accounts, I didn't actually communicate with many of the people, but I did use hundreds of those thousands of accounts that I thought well represented different topics or ideas that I wanted to express. As a psychologist too, and I would say that I write as a spiritualist more than a psychologist, but I use my knowledge of psychology to give context to some of the content in the near-death experience. But I did also run across about six or seven people who had near-death experiences. And it wasn't as though I was looking for these folks. It was another synchronicity that maybe was divinely created that I would meet these people. And through these interviews, I was able to write a few special chapters on really interesting deep near-death experiences and included some other accounts from people I interviewed and weaved them throughout my chapters. So basically, we used a wide sample of folks, especially from the NDERF website, to give firsthand accounts of very deep, meaningful spiritual truths, or at least truths according to the people who come back. And I call these folks our ambassadors from heaven. In terms of your other question, Ashley, you know, I certainly learned a lot about what a near-death experience is. There's very popular today in modern media through books or through television or even movies that near-death experiences really tantalize the public's interest. But I would add that they are more than just good feelings, tunnels, and love, and all these wonderful things that people experience. Yes, they are amazing stories, and they do give people hope, but there's a lot of deep meaning with near-death experiences, theologically, if you will, or philosophically, they answer questions such as, who are we? What is our purpose on earth? What is the nature of God? Where are we going? And so forth. But at a more elemental level, to answer your question, what is a near-death experience? It's when either a person dies or enters a coma and their soul or spirit leaves their body and they proceed into a different dimensional realm, one that is filled with spiritual beings, one that is interconnected. There is a unity between all spiritual beings, and there is an interconnection and fabric based on love. So there's also an expanded consciousness that comes with this unity, and just an amazing teaching experiences for people. So that's, in a very nutshell, is what a near-death experience is like. And what's really interesting about them is that people have the same underlying elements, regardless of age, culture, nationality, gender. So an agnostic will have a similar experience as a Hindu. Or a five-year-old who hasn't watched Oprah yet or doesn't know anything about near-death experiences may have the same elements as somebody who's 75. So I think that gives a lot of credibility to near-death experiences, is the reliability of these experiences.
You know, I kind of find, from my research, I feel like a near-death experience kind of reminds you of an out-of-body experience. And yes. I think that when people have out-of-body experiences, and people can have out-of-body experiences just going to sleep and just kind of meditating and relaxing, I think that a near-death experience could be maybe even more powerful, but I think it's kind of the same principle.
I would agree with that. In both instances, the soul is leaving the body. But the difference is an out-of-body experience generally is a very temporary type activity that is limited to this earthly spiritual plane. Whereas a near-death experience, somebody actually goes into the spiritual realm. Maybe not everywhere in the spiritual realm, but they go into the spiritual realm far enough where they communicate with deceased loved ones, with spiritual guides, with Jesus, with God, and with other hosts of spiritual beings. You typically don't have that level of interaction with out-of-body experiences. What is interesting is that when people first have their near-death experience, or if they have a very brief near-death experience, they do have an out-of-body experience where they're looking down at their body, maybe from the corner of the hospital room, and they see doctors and nurses operating on themselves. And that may only last for a brief moment before they are taken to another location, another spiritual location, where they interact with other spiritual beings.
Let me ask you, when you think about these near-death experiences, I'm always interested, is there like one or two consistencies that you find across the board in almost every one of these recounts?
Absolutely. I think there's about a dozen or maybe even 20, 25 things that are usually present in most of them. And I would say that, well, let me back up and say that there may be 20, 25 key elements that are same throughout near-death experiences. Not everybody who has a near-death experience are going to experience all the elements. After all, many of near-death experiences are very brief, and they may just include an out-of-body experience. But some of the key elements is basically a profound sense of peace, love, interconnection, that their soul can experience knowledge at the asking, that the soul can be at any place just by thinking about it, souls are energy, so they actually don't see or hear things like we do. They see things and know things, quote unquote, by knowing them. So you could look at a block of wood and know it from the molecular level, or you can see the whole universe happen from that perspective, from one moment to the next, depending on what you decide to look at. Not only is through this interconnection a sense of knowing, but there's also timelessness. That's another thing that people who have near-death experiences report, is that here on Earth, we experience time as a series, a flow of now. So the past we can barely remember, and the future we can only guess at. Up there, time is more experienced as a singularity, where there isn't the time of the seconds or of the clock to measure time. Rather, time can be experienced quite short or quite long. The past can be experienced just like the future, and things become jumbled. So I would call it relative time up there. But perhaps the most impactful commonality of people who have near-death experiences is the intense love they feel. Some people say it's like being in a swimming pool, where every molecule of your body is infused with love. Another person said, if she added all the loving moments in her life into one moment, it would not equal to a moment of the love in heaven. That's incredible, powerful love. And it's no accident that people who go up there and they're told they have to return throw a tantrum. They don't want to return to this earth. They realize that they're home. And that's another commonality. Spiritual beings, when they go up there, they start remembering that this is their home and that Earth is actually a type of school. So these are the type of commonalities in the near-death experience. I can give two discrepant cultural near-death experiences to illustrate this commonality if you're interested.
Yeah, for sure, Roy. Let's do that when we return back from the break, because I want to talk about that, and I want to talk more about our connection with the love. So stay tuned. We're going to be talking more about that, more about these near-death experiences, and also more about, you know, if we have these accounts and we know this to be true and there's thousands or hundreds of thousands of people that have experienced this, why can't we take this into our day-to-day life? Stay tuned, because Live Your True Life Perspectives with your host, me, Ashley Burgess, will be back in, be back this time in two shakes.
This is Jake Busey, and you're listening to Perspectives with Ashley Burgess.
Welcome back live to Live Your True Life Perspectives, and I'm your host, Ashley Burgess. Tonight I've been talking with Roy Hill. Roy has written an amazing book on near-death experiences, Psychology in the Near-Death Experience, Searching for God. And it's very interesting because right before the break, Roy was talking about some of the accounts and some of the consistencies that he's found across the board in these near-death experiences. And we were ending up on the last segment discussing the concept of the flow of love. And later on in the hour, I want to talk about, you know, with all these cases and with all these people that have experienced this, why can't we take this into our own life? But before we went to break, Roy, you were actually explaining a couple of different archetypes or something that you were wanting to explain kind of on the concept of near-death experience. And I want you to talk about that real quick before we get into a couple of the chapters that I wanted to share with our listeners that really, really are inspirational.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Ashley. So the first account involves a Native American man. When he had his near-death experience, what was manifest for him, and when I mean manifest, everything is energy. So if you ask, what does heaven look like? It looks like whatever is created for us. And when we are moving over there in the transition, usually it looks a lot like earthly things that make us feel comfortable, culturally relevant things that ease our transition to the other side. So with this gentleman, when he went up there, he saw a school bus. He went into the school bus, and there were elders, deceased elders, having a peyote ceremony. He thought, oh, this is great. Mm-hmm. This is what's happened to him. So when he went into the school bus, he touched the edge of the school bus, and what he felt was an interconnection of all living things, within a singularity of time. He felt an incredible love for him and everything around him. And he felt great intelligence behind all this interconnected unity within the school bus. Take the second example. Here's a man who is a staunch Catholic who believes if you don't do all the sacraments and rites and rituals, you're going to go to hell. So he goes up there. What's manifest for him? But a big Catholic cathedral. So he beelines it into confession like any good Catholic. An arm comes out. He touches the arm and realizes it's Jesus. But rather than confessing his sins, what does he experience? He experiences the same thing as the native does. Peace and love and interconnection and great intelligence behind it and an unconditional love for all beings. Then he realizes that there's nothing for him to confess.
That's interesting. I think it's interesting, like when relatives come back, and I know we're not talking about this tonight, but you know, people have had accounts where their relatives, they've seen a past a deceased relative and had a communication with them in a dream or what have you, and oftentimes they say, you know, that these relatives come back in a very peaceful way. And in a way that makes people feel very comfortable. And I think that's kind of the underlying thing is these near-death experiences aren't created to make you freak out and basically go unconscious. It's to make you feel comfortable in whatever you've kind of surrounded yourself with, believing is maybe like your kind of personal doctrine or how you feel comfortable in your own day-to-day life.
Absolutely. Although in this case with the Catholic gentleman, Jesus had a couple messages for him before he sent him back that may have been a little bit challenging for him. Jesus said, it's time for you to go back, and I don't want you to lie to others or to yourself anymore. And then he sent him back. So there was also a teaching component to this near-death experience where you find in many near-death experiences. But I think the important point to all this is that there are culturally relevant things we see on the other side to help our transition. And as you said, to allow us to feel comfortable, yet the underlying structure is the same. And I wanted to stress that point again, because 3-7% of people, in at least based on surveys in the United States, Canada, Europe, and Australia, have had near-death experiences. Now, how many people is that in the United States? That's 15 million people in the United States alone. You can't stop the impact of so many people. In terms of believing whether it is real, imagine you're on a jury. And somebody's been accused of stealing something, maybe a television. And you have one witness say, I saw this guy steal the television. If that's all you have, it's probably not enough to convict the alleged perpetrator. What if you had 5 people? You might convict. What if you had 100 people say, yep, saw that guy steal that TV? They're going to convict. What if you had 15 million people say the same thing? There wouldn't be a doubt in your mind that this is real. And that's the power of the near-death experience and how we can trust it is real. When you have 15 million people in the United States and alone saying the same thing, you can't ignore that as just happenstance. You can't get 2 or 3 people in a room and agree on spiritual issues. on religious issues.
I think that's interesting. And let's take this a step further. So, you know, I'm a big believer. You know, I meditate on a constant basis. I believe in the heart space meditation. I work on that on a constant day, on a constant basis. But let's just say that people aren't really on that, wanting to really go down that track. When you have 15 million people, okay, that come from all different walks of life, every race, every different color, every different creed, that have some of the same accounts, why do you feel that our society as a whole, and I'm not speaking to some people listening to this show are completely spiritual, very deep thinkers, meditate on a constant basis, but the majority of our society doesn't. Why do you feel that in the eyes of the reality here that people avoid working on personal, spiritual level of life? Why do people want to keep into this formidable, you know, let's have a bunch of things, let's only care about the way we dress, let's think about only money. Why do you feel that so many people are stuck in the third dimensional thinking when the reality is so overwhelmingly obvious?
That's a good question, and it really says a lot about the human brain. I believe that human beings are very emotional animals, and that we tend to make decisions based on what we want to hear, what makes us feel good. And I think there's all sorts of things in on this earth, other than near-death experiences, where people choose to ignore because it's inconvenient. At our core animal self, we want to feed the self. And working 20 years in prisons, I learned that the criminal mentality is this: I want what I want, when I want it, and I don't care what I have to do to get what I want. If people get hurt in the process, so be it. Obviously, this mentality has left some people to go to prison because they break the law. But this mentality is pervasive, I think, in our human society. It's just that most people find legal ways to get what they want. And this pursuit of ego goes in many different ways. It includes creating little monuments of ego, of wealth, of a little bit of recognition or fame. When people have their life review, when they have a near-death experience, and that is where their life is reviewed from birth to death, mm-hmm. what God or the spiritual beings around this person having a life review cares about is not all these things that we care about here on earth. They don't care about our little monuments to ego. They care only how much did you learn how to love. And really that goes to the very basic meaning of life. And some of your listeners may wonder, what is life about? That's a good question, because great thinkers have been considering that question for thousands of years. And people who have near-death experiences have the answer, at least they report they have the answer. And the answer is, we come to Earth as a school to learn what we lack in love. I'm not talking about love as an emotion. I'm talking about love as skill set, such as sacrifice, inherent respect, forgiveness, all those tough things that we need to learn how to love. Because our animal instincts is not to love, is to fulfill the self. And in order to overcome those animal instincts, we have to rely on our spirit or soul or interconnection with God to overcome these things. And unfortunately, in today's society, we're not seeing that. We're living on computers and watching television. And our whole purpose to life is to learn how to love, and that involves interacting with other people. And if we're spending our time in a virtual world, we're not interacting with other people effectively. We're missing out the very mission in life. And so we get whole society has become increasingly disconnected from their purpose and from God and from the love that needs to be taught. And so the message goes deaf on people who are mostly interested in being soothed and entertained and to fulfill their little monuments to self.
Wow, that makes total sense. It's kind of sad, though, being a therapist as well. I work with clients all the time that I just wish could get to that next level, and when they start working on it, it's just, I don't know. A lot of people like to go backwards because it's more comfortable.
Absolutely, it is more comfortable, yes. The God path, the spiritual path to fulfill our mission is the hard path. If I can give a couple examples of that.
Yes, actually, Roy, when we return back here from the break, I'd love to hear some of those examples.
Very good.
So stay tuned for these examples and us to really go in depth on this concept and how you can basically power up, because I think this information is information that we all need to know to get to that next level, because really, in honesty, the reason why we're here on this planet is because of this. Stay tuned. Live Your True Life Perspectives with your host, me, Ashley Burgess. Well, you know what? I'll be back. I think I'll be back in two shakes.
Get in here. You're listening to Perspectives with Ashley Burgess.
Welcome back live to Live Your True Life Perspectives, and I'm your host, Ashley Burgess. Tonight I'm talking with a friend of mine, Roy Hill. We're talking about near-death experiences. We're talking about love. We're really talking about the reason why we're all here on this planet. And right before the break, Roy was giving us some examples that I really want to talk about. Roy, could you continue on that line of thought before we get into some of the chapters that I want to kind of illuminate for folks listening tonight?
Sure. When I'm talking about mission, Ashley, our purpose for existence, I'm really talking about difficult things to learn. Things that people, I think, want to avoid because they are difficult. And let me give you a couple examples. One aspect of love is to forgive. Okay? It's one thing to forgive a friend who may have made an off-colored comment and says, I'm sorry about that. Okay? That's easy to forgive. But what about if you had a special somebody, maybe a spouse, who stabs you in the back and leaves you without apology, a friend who steals from you, or does something really egregious and hurts you at the core? That's hard to forgive. Those are the difficult lessons of love we're meant to learn here. Let me give you another example. Inherent respect. It's easy to respect a professor or maybe a parent who has been successful and is modeling good things for you. But what about respecting that homeless person? That's more difficult. Somebody who's different and downtrodden, or somebody with a disability, or somebody who is in a nursing home. Displaying inherent respect for such individuals, for many people, is more difficult. And a last example is sacrifice. It's one thing to help a buddy move his furniture and sacrifice your afternoon to do that, but it's quite another if you have to quit your job and take care of an ailing parent who has Alzheimer's disease and watch your parent's mental faculties decline over the next several years before they pass away.
Oh,
that
yeah.
Type of caretaking activity, yes, is extremely hard. And these are the experiences in life that we learn. This is where we fulfill our purpose and our mission to become closer to the source, to become more light-like, to be more God-like, by becoming more loving. And why do we come to Earth to do this, Ashley? It's because up in the spiritual realm, spiritual beings are connected with this love. They have no sickness, they have no death, they have no conflicts or great concerns. This is a wonderful place to experience the bliss of heaven, which they do. But it's not a good place to become individuals through direct experience. It's one thing to learn about it in the spiritual realm, but it's another thing to learn through direct experience to become who we want to become through our own free will. And in that growth process, where do we learn things the most? From good things? Yes, true. But even more so through adversity. So when bad things come your way, and this is, I think, an important point for your listeners, it's easy to shake your fist at God and say, why, God, why do you give this to me? Why am I suffering? Why are you letting this difficulty or this pain to come into my life? And the answer is because you chose it for your own growth. Because you are here on school earth, the tough schoolyard of earth, to learn through these adversities to grow. And this is the choice we all made to do, to come here. Now, when I die and go to heaven, I don't want to go to God and say, well, God, I had this mission, and what did I do? Well, I watched a lot of television. No, I want to go up there and say, yeah, I'm serious. I want to go up there and say, God, you know, I went through all these difficult things, and I learned this and this from it, and I tried to do better, and I think this was a productive life. That's what I hope to do.
I agree with you, and I agree. It's interesting you brought up the classroom concept. As a child, you know, I was born, and I was born with a condition that nobody understood, and it wasn't until 20-some-odd years later, after experimental surgeries and almost dying on the operating table four different times and everything else, going through that process and finally getting a diagnosis and realize, you know, you're one out of 180 in the world. Wow, you know, I feel like I won the lottery. And I knew, though, the whole time, which was odd, even as a child, that this area here that we're in is a classroom. And yeah. And it was interesting. Even then, I had a lot of I call it deathbed wisdom. I'm actually I was told that that would be a bad title for a book, but I'm still writing it anyway. But it's like I felt like every single day I didn't know if that was going to be the last day. And so the way that I handled relationships with people, I think, is a lot different than most people deal with. Because if you really think about it, most of us just assume that, you know, our lives are just as long as we want it. Everything's going to be fine. We can say hi. You know, we can yell at somebody. We can say whatever we want to. And, you know, it doesn't really matter because we'll have the next day to make up for it. But I just didn't see life like that. And I think it's interesting, and I want to talk more about this when we come back from break, but you brought up the concept of TV. And I do find that nowadays, I know that, you know, because of the technology we have, because of the surge of, there's serotonin, there's all kinds of different chemical surges in our brain that when we get certain technologies, when we connect with certain things on our phone, one of the latest things that people are doing right now is what we call binge watching, where people are watching a TV show and they're binge watching 12 episodes in a day.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know about you, but when we return, I want to talk about some various chapters, but I really want to focus on in this next segment talking about chapter 9 of your book, The End of Isolation. And I want you to talk more about how a lot of this TV and a lot of the things that we're engaging in is an isolated event. We're isolating ourselves. And if you're thinking about watching, if you watch TV 3 hours a day, the impact that has on your life. So stay tuned. When we return, we'll be talking about chapter 9, and we're going to have Roy really expound on his concept of isolationism and how our society has kind of, pretty much endorsed it. Stay tuned, because Live Your True Life Perspectives, your host, me, Ashley Burtis, will be back this time in two shakes.
You're in a good place now. You are listening to Perspectives with Ashley Burgess.
Welcome back live to Live Your True Life Perspectives, and I'm your host, Ashley Burgess. Joining me tonight is Roy Hill. Roy wrote The Psychology and the Near-Death Experience, Searching for God. And we were talking about near-death experiences, but right now we're going to discuss kind of the TV world we're in the end of isolation. Roy, let's talk about your chapter 9 in the book, because I think this really connected with me, because I think this talks a lot about isolationism, but also how TV is a direct component to this.
Yes, Ashley, thank you very much. You know, people think TV is sort of an innocuous, not important thing. But what I have found is that based on research, there is a direct, strong correlation between decreases in social activities of charitable organizations and reaching out as a community to those who are hurt and hopeless, or even spending time knowing and interacting with neighbors across the gamut with the advent of television. And the reason is, according to research, is that people on average are spending 3.5 hours of their day watching television. But it gets worse. Now people are adding 1.5 hours of internet use on average a day as well. So 5 hours may not sound like a lot, but if you factor in 8 hours of sleep, 8 hours of work, commuting to and from work, doing errands, and everything else, then TV and internet is taking the majority of people's lives. And what are we living in a virtual world? How are we to fulfill our mission in a virtual world?
And I don't know. And that's the key, is that oftentimes I find clients that come into my office and they are so mesmerized by the TV, by the latest show. And, you know, and I find it interesting. I want to sidetrack here real quick. For a lot of the listeners tonight, I think that most people would agree with me that a lot of the movies and a lot of the shows right now, I mean, are we just accepting this content because that's all there is? I mean, I got a higher standard for the things that I watch. And like I was saying on a couple of shows before, is that you can't unsee what you see and you can't unhear what you hear. And I think a lot of times people don't think about that kind of stuff when it comes to their subconscious mind.
Absolutely. And in the last hour, I think we were talking about the animal, human, and the soul. Because what near-death experience people tell us is that their soul or their spirit, their true self, melds with the human being. Now, in a bad aspect, the human brain is a very limited organism. So the spiritual soul has actually limited itself in knowledge and experience and understanding when it enters a human brain. But it's for a very special purpose. And the purpose, as explained during the last hour, is to be somewhat disconnected, to be on our own, and to learn what we lack in love through our own free will. And our physical bodies allow us to do that. Now, going back to the television and the internet, what is the basis of all these shows? For most of them, we'll say all of them, but most of them, it's the animal human. Sex, aggression, violence. Freud, back 100 years ago, would say these are all id components. These are all biological drives of the human being based on our evolution. So if our goal, if our purpose is to overcome these biological drives to some degree by asserting our higher self or soul, and that's the purpose of our existence, how are we going to do that watching television that's increasingly based on competition through reality television, aggression, sex, and all these other things that just repeat it over and over and over? So for many people, that's all they're filling their minds with. And so there's no question why our world seems more disengaged, more lost, and where reality television seems to be become blurred into our everyday lives.
I agree with you, especially these murder shows too. Like all these murder shows out there, it's all about, you know, how to get away with murder. I mean, honestly, come on.
Yeah, and if you go down to a magazine aisle, any grocery store, go to the grocery store. How many science history magazines are there? Maybe one. Maybe one. But you have large sections for women's magazines that have to do with physical beauty and romance and sex. You have men's magazines that are basically based on power and sex. You have muscle magazines based on power. You have gun magazines that are based on overt power, where guns are meant to kill things. And that's a huge, huge section there. And on and on, car magazines, you know, and it's all based on these very primitive human drivings. I'm not trying to be moralistic. We inherit our biology. It's part of us. And I don't think we need to deny our humanness. But if we allow these baser animal instincts to become us, and where the soul becomes diminished and not any important anymore, then that's really limiting our experience on Earth and whole purpose to be here.
I agree with you, and I do find it's interesting because I don't know. It's I guess maybe it was because of what I was born with and the transition that I had to go through. But you're right. It just doesn't really resonate with me. And it was until recently, and this will probably get you to laugh, Roy. This will get most people listening to this show to laugh. You know, I just assume that people could see through. For a long time, I assumed that the majority of people could hear when somebody's talking the truth, when somebody's spreading knowledge. And I didn't think that the look or the clothes mattered. And maybe I actually always knew on this earthly plane that to some degree that was real, and maybe I was fighting it. And that might be that might be more of the truth there. But it's interesting how, to me, there's just a different level of thought and a different level of spirit when it comes to engaging in, you know, the dog and pony show, what is expected. And it just, I don't know, it's just, to me, it's like, right, it's like garbage in, garbage out. And I'm not saying that you have to pretend that you're unhuman, but don't, I mean, I guess, how do we help people figure out how to have, you know, something kind of in the middle, or maybe to realize that a lot of this content is, I think, is being shifted because there's two reasons. One, people are actually, they're paying for it. They're eating it up. They're sopping it up like, you know, like a gravy in a biscuit. But also, I believe that there's a deliberate reason why this type of content is being produced and is being handed out to the masses. And I think it's to cause people to not realize their true reason to be here. Because I mean, I think that there's a bigger reason behind it. Because if we all knew that we were all connected, and we obviously are all connected, even if you look through, like, you know, like your, like, what do they call it when they do like the family tree, and you can see where everybody's kind of connected. I mean, even, I was doing some research the other day, and even Brad Pitt and Obama, the president of the United States, are actually related down in their family tree. I think they're like ninth cousins or something like that. And so if we all realize that we're all connected, right, and to realize that we're supposed to unify and to love one another, I think as a group, as a whole, we would become a tribe. And then that tribe would inherently be able to make decisions for themselves. But I think because we have all this disconnect and chaos and all this content that we're dealing with on a daily basis, it really separates people from their true identity.
Oh, I agree 100%. And the first step for a spiritual revolution here on Earth is to become aware. It's only the first step. You have to act. You have to grow. But I don't think that people are even aware. And if you're not aware, then how can you make good decisions? So I wanted to say a little bit more about this interconnection to increase the awareness of folks who may not be aware of this. In the spiritual realm, what people realize in a near-death experience is that we're all loved equally by God, regardless of our spiritual maturity. So I'll give you an analogy. If I have a toddler who reaches for a frosted cupcake, and it's not supposed to, do I get angry at that toddler? Do I love that toddler less? No, I realize that this toddler is at an early stage of development and doesn't know better. And I think in a spiritual realm, many people on earth, well, everybody on earth, is at early stages of development. And that's okay, because we are just beginning. Infinity is a long time, so we have a long time to learn these things. But why waves coming down here on earth to kind of stunt that process by not being aware or trying to learn? But what people say on the other side is that they realize this unity comes from everything being of God. So you and I are both the conscious expression of God, except we're giving the gift of our own individuality, of our own free will. It's a bit of an illusion, that, because underneath all that is really, we're really one. And up in the spiritual realm, we're all beings of energy, orbs of energy. There is no race. There is no hard and fast gender. So when I look at another human being, maybe of a different race, of a different religion, whatever, I try to remind myself that person at heart is a orb of energy, just like me, an expression of God. And if we all realize that we're all expressions of God, why would we hurt one another? Because what we do to others, we do to ourselves. Because we're all one. And that's probably worth repeating. What we do to others, we do to ourselves. And that is the beginning of awareness.
I agree with you, Roy. And when we return, we'll be talking more about that and more about what we do to others and how that impacts our life. So stay tuned, because Live Your True Life Perspectives with your host, me, Ashley Bird, will be back this time in two shakes.
Turn it up and jump in the deep end on Perspectives. Now, here's Ashley.
Welcome back live to Live Your True Life Perspectives, and I'm your host, Ashley Burgess. Joining me tonight, Roy Hill. We've been talking about the end of isolation. We've been talking about near-death experiences. And right now, we're talking about how what we do directly impacts ourselves. And I was thinking about, in the last segment, you were talking about, you know, how what we do to others directly impacts us. And I thought of something that was really funny, Roy. You know, I don't know about you, but have you ever driven down the road and somebody cuts you off, and then they cut you off, and then they give you the bird?
Yes.
Okay.
It's hard to keep one's emotions in check.
It can be. I've successfully figured out how to do that, because I'm not going to let them ruin my day. And I don't smile or wave either. I just keep on going. I'm not trying to get a rise out of them either. I just get out of the way and keep on moving. But the funniest thing is, the first person that sees that bird is the person that gives it.
Yeah.
And I find that interesting. The first person that hears the F-bomb when somebody is cussing someone else is the person that says it. And I think that has a great impact that a lot of people don't realize, is that we directly impact our life by what we do to others. And I think this directly relates to what you were just talking about.
Oh, absolutely, Ashley. Working in prisons in 20 years, I talked about the criminal mindset. I want what I want when I want. And basically, on another aspect of that criminal mindset is, it's everybody else's fault. So, you know, that also stunts growth. I think we're also, within this age of isolation, not taking responsibility for our own actions. That a lot of the things that we're experiencing, negative things, are based on choices that we made. But it's easier to blame other people for these things. And it's not to say that other people and events are not factors and contributors to it, but even in really difficult situations, you have two choices. You can learn from that difficult situation, or you can be traumatized by that difficult situation. Now, I'm not talking about serious traumas, you know, in case of rape or war, you know, where people have PTSD. I understand there's a deeper complexity to all this. But I'm just talking about general adversity. When things bad happen in our lives, how do we take that? Some people learn from the experience. Other people I think, are hurt by the experience and blame those difficult experiences to their own poor choices in life. So, yes, I would agree that what we do to others, we do to ourselves. And that's just one way in which we do that.
Yeah, I mean, I was recently in a conversation, this was actually yesterday, and a friend of mine was telling me that she's involved with a book club, and that one of the women in the book club started, she was reading this book, and I think it was C.S. Lewis, I think it was The Great Divorce or something like that, and they were talking about it, and one of the girls that was in the book club was like, you know what, I'm still angry. And she's like, about the book or what? and in this book, you know, it was about how people have to let things go to get to that next level, to move forward. And we have to let things go that we hold on to. And she didn't realize this girl had lost both of her parents in an auto accident when she was 5. And she was raised by her aunt and uncle. And this lady now is 45. 40 years later, and still is angry and mad about what happened. And I understand the loss of a family like that, and I understand how overwhelming that can be. But if we look at it in reality and we say, okay, yes, that's painful, and yes, that is sad, and yes, at some point we have to let this go. And we have to forgive it, and we have to move on, because otherwise, whatever we're holding on to that is negative, that is of that mindset, basically holds us back from moving on to the next level.
Yes, and I would caution to say letting go sounds like an instantaneous action. And I would say letting go is a process for everybody. Especially when you were talking about such a difficult thing as losing one's parents. And so that process may take even more than a lifetime. So I don't want to gloss over people's pain and say, you just need to let it go. I realize that it's more difficult than just a singular action, that this is a process. But some people go further and faster on this process than others. And one point of awareness, let's take the example of the woman who lost her parents as a child. In the Gospel of Thomas, which is not in the Bible, but I really like it, Jesus said, be passerby, which means to go through life without any attachments to the material realm. You're part of the world, but you're not attached to the world. You're like a visitor. You go through life as a passerby. If you do that and realize that really your mission's important, whatever it takes, then you have a better large perspective of why you're here on Earth. And then if you truly believe in life after death and that there is home in heaven rather than Earth, you realize there's nothing to fear. One person who had a near-death experience 700 years ago, Julia Norwich, she said, all that is not well will be well. And what that means is that nothing here on this earth matters except for the love we give and the relationships that we take with us back. And all these other things are really not important. One spiritual being, an angel, what was considered an angel, told one Indian that 99% of what people experience here on earth is motivated by fear. You know, in fear of keeping up with the Joneses, fear of making enough money, or else this will happen or that will happen. And so we're motivated by fear. A lot of the prejudices and divisions that we see on the earth today are motivated by fear. But there really is nothing to fear. In the case of this 40-some-year-old woman, her parents are with her in a way that they're closer to her now than they ever were in the past. When people have near-death experiences, they often meet deceased relatives, parents, grandparents, people they love. And what do those deceased people say? They said, oh, we love you so much. We miss you. And we're with you every moment of the day, with your every thought. And so we're really never alone, even though we feel alone. And if this woman really knew how much her deceased parents are with her and loved her and looking forward to the reunion, maybe that would take some of her sting away.
I agree with you. I think oftentimes, too, the anger we hold on to colors our judgment and colors what we actually get to see in this world. So maybe
Absolutely.
Her family has come to her in some sort of way, but she can't see it, or she deems it as a myth or drug-induced or whatever that could be. And I think sometimes, too, that anger does divide us from who we are. And I've experienced anger in my life in my past, and I experienced anger with a family member, and I had to work at that. And it took me years to overcome that. But then I realized that no matter what that person does, I still love them. And it took a while to get there. But once I did, it changes everything. Because once you figure out how to honestly love everybody and basically thwart and let go of judgment, life becomes a lot easier.
Well, forgiveness is liberating.
Yes.
When you hold a grudge, who's it hurt the most? It hurts you, not the other person. Anger is such a powerful, toxic emotion, as well as fear, its cousin fear, that if you experience so much anger in your life and fear in your life, there's no room for any positive emotion because it's so toxic and powerful, it just runs over any other emotion. And that's not how I want to live. That's not the basis of my growth, to live in a constant anger and fear. And fear of the future, of course, is anxiety. And so people are living and this life of fear, anger, and anxiety, and a lot of times it's based on their own perception of events. And it's not really the events that are causing them, but it's their own perception of events. So if somebody is hurt and cannot forgive and holds a grudge, that's going to affect their own life even more than the person they're angry at.
I totally agree. And when we return, are we talking more about love and fear and more about things that you can do in your life to make some changes and to really find the unique direction that maybe you're looking for as far as a purpose is concerned? Stay tuned. We're going to turn Live Your True Life Perspectives with your host, me, Ashley Burgess. We'll be back this time in two shakes.
This is Jake Busey, and you're listening to Perspectives with Ashley Burgess.
Welcome back to Live Your True Life Perspectives, and I'm your host, Ashley Burgess. Joining me this evening, Roy Hill, and I have been talking about near-death experiences, the psychology and the near-death experience, searching for God. And right before the break, we were really tackling some stuff that's at the core of the root of why we are here on this planet, about unconditional love, about the nature of God. And Roy, you know, when we were on break earlier, we were kind of talking about this. Let's talk more about that unconditional love and really the reason why we're here.
Yes, of course, the reason why we're here is to learn how to love, to be more closely consistent with God's love, which is a perfect love. Now, I grew up as a Baptist, as I mentioned, and I remain a Christian, not a Baptist anymore, but as a Christian, nevertheless, is very open to a lot of spiritual input from a variety of sources. But what people who have near-death experiences say is that God has a perfect unconditional love. Now, in the tradition that I grew up in, they say that God has perfect love, but it doesn't sound like it's unconditional. Because with unconditional love means that there can be no judgment. It goes against God's perfect loving nature to judge. Let me go back to the analogy a little earlier about the child with the toddler with the frosted cupcake. Do we forever punish the toddler because he reaches for the cupcake, maybe puts it around his face? No, we understand that the child is developmentally immature. And likewise, we are spiritually immature. We come to planet Earth with the expectation that we're going to make mistakes, and that is part of the plan for us to come down here and to make mistakes, because that's how we learn, that's how we grow, that's how we spiritually evolve, through a spiral of lessons that go on for eternity. So if we take a look at that in plan, then you ask yourself, do I have to fear God? And the answer is no, you don't have to fear God. When people have their life reviews, they learn things that they did well, and they learn things they wish they could have done better. And some of those things they could have done better or things they did well are pointed out. But yet there's no judgment from the other side. The only beings that judge is ourselves when we have a life review. So they're all about lessons and not about judgment. So this is the perfect nature of a loving God, not a stern being standing on the throne, but rather a gentle energy that pervades everything and all of us. And God isn't forgiving, because when there's unconditional love, there's nothing to forgive. Like the person who was the staunch Catholic had his near-death experience, he realized there was nothing to confess. That doesn't mean that we don't need to try to do better or to have a conscience. This doesn't give us a green light to do whatever we want, because spiritual beings want to grow. They want to better themselves. They want to evolve. But the belief in a judgmental, angry God is not consistent with what our ambassadors from heaven are reporting from the other side.
I agree with that. I think, and I also don't understand why. I don't know where it came from or why it started, but when people say that they're a God-fearing man.
Yes.
You know, I mean, I feel like that's the opposite. I mean, like, if you consider God love, then why would you fear love? And I think to go to what you were talking about just now, you know, when you think about this kind of stuff and you said it's not giving you the green light to go out and go crazy. I think it's even setting the bar higher,
because yes.
I think if we look at it from a different angle, we realize the aspect of what we can attain. I think that would even want to, I guess, fuel the internal passion of fire to do better, to be better spiritually, to impact the world. How do people really begin to do that in their own life?
First of all, I think that's very well said. I couldn't agree more. In terms of how we do in our own life, it involves being other-centered instead of self-centered, to give up the ego, to try to be one with others and humanity, to try to express your love. And it doesn't have to be perfect. All you have to do is step out of yourself and reach out. I had a friend who kind of lived a selfish life, but decided to help kids by giving them computers. And that was life transforming, just that one act of unselflessness. She felt so good inside, and she felt a hole being filled, that she continued to do helping acts towards others. And so I would say for people, find an area where you can help. There's so many areas in the world that are hurting. There's so many areas you can volunteer, you know, and you don't have to have any specific skills. If you can put a can into a box for a homeless person, then you can be of service. But we can be service to our families. We can be service to our neighborhoods. We can be service to people in need in our communities. We can go through environmental cause or a political cause. You name it. There are so many ways you can go beyond yourself to try this, to make this world a better place. And when you do that, you will fulfill your mission. People say, well, what is my mission? My answer is that you don't need to know your mission, because your life was created that your mission will come to you, where you were placed in your family, in your country or community, whatever. All this was created for you, that your mission will come to you to learn what you lack in love. All you have to do is be open in love.
I agree with that. And I agree oftentimes, you know, when it comes to mission and purpose, you know, it's almost like, am I on purpose? Am I on point? And I agree with you. If you're open to it and you're honest with yourself, but also it's about learning. And you know, I see sometimes people say, well, I left it up to God, and so I'll figure it out. And I agree that that's part of it, but I really believe that we all have to work toward what it is that we have in our life. And I know that we can give things, certain things up that we can't control, but otherwise we do have a degree of control in our life to say, okay, I believe that there's more to my life than meets the eye, and I'm going to, for some of us, pray, for some of us, meditate, which I think is about the same thing, to really focus on that and to give time. And I think, I'm not saying to take away the TV altogether, but I'm saying it would be awesome to take maybe an hour of that TV time and really focus on making your life on Earth better. But what's the stuff that's holding it together for the later on, for the next lifetime?
Correct. Exactly. And really trying to be other-centered. You don't have to be perfect. The goal is not to be perfect. The goal is to become better.
Because there is no perfection. You know, I mean perfection is
not on this earth.
not on this earth. And I think, though, but we can work to be better. We can work to be that person that unconditionally loves. We can work at it. And I think as we work at it, it starts with us. It starts with accepting your own faults, accepting your own, you know, setbacks, working to better those, but also to find that self-love. Because I think when we self-love, we don't like others. We don't love others. We find the problem. We want people to jump through the hoops. We want people to do this and that. And then maybe then I might love you. And that's so far from reality. It's all about loving yourself. And once you can see that compassion and what changes in your life by actually honestly loving yourself for the spirit you are, it changes everything.
Yes, if we're all expressions of God, then we're all heirs of the kingdom. And we all have potential of growth and to become one with the divine. And so really, people like Anita Morjani talk about when they had their death experience and come back, they said, I realize that my soul is magnificent, not only in scope and ability, but in just worth and how much it's loved. And people fail to see that in themselves because their society has so many ways to devalue people.
Exactly.
And I think it's so important for people to realize their own magnificence.
And so let me ask you, Roy, I have your book and I love it. And it's absolutely amazing. Tell the listeners where they can find your book and all that good information so they too can read it.
Well, thank you. Yeah. So this book is a little different than some of just the wonderful, hopeful, good feeling stories that people have about their own near-death experience, and there's much to learn from that. But this book really kind of echoes a lot of the conversations we had today. It takes a look at the underlying meanings of near-death experiences to really get into the meat of the issue. A lot of spiritual seekers really enjoy it. So the way you can get it is through, of course, Amazon.com. I have it on paperback as well as Kindle version, Apple iTunes, and BarnesandNoble.com. And it's in a few bookstores, too. So anyway, those are some places to find it. And you can also go to my website, where not only is the book there, but also some quotes from the book and some interesting information and things that I have done and maybe will be doing here in terms of events. And that is www.neardeath, spell that out, near death, exppsy.com. It's near death, exppsy.com.
Awesome. I will be checking out your website too. And I know that our listeners have learned a lot tonight and look forward to having you back on the show as well, Roy. Thank you for coming on tonight.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's been a real pleasure.
Well, God bless you. I think this was a great interview. When we return, I'll be talking a little bit more about love and how you can really look at yourself and stop devaluing yourself on a day-to-day basis. Stay tuned because Live Your True Life Perspectives with your host, me, Ashley Burgess. We'll be back this time in two shakes.
You could be my luck. Get in here. You're listening to Perspectives with Ashley Burgess. Be safe and sound. I can
Welcome back live to Live Your True Life Perspectives, and I'm your host, Ashley Burgess. What a great interview with Roy Hill. I learned a lot, and you know, I think a lot of it resonated with the way I feel, resonated with the truth that I had believed. And I don't believe in like doctrines, I believe in ideas. You can always change an idea, right? Yeah. You can always change an idea. It's not set in stone. There's no stone tablets that you got to go, you know, get out there and, you know, chisel away at some of the words and add some little, you know, carrots and changes to it, you know, augment it. No, you don't have to do that. You know, so it was really interesting. The last segment, Roy and I were talking about how, you know, until we really love ourselves, we kind of miss the boat. And I know people go, oh, well, yeah, I love myself, you know, I'm okay with myself, my Lord. I mean, what the heck do you want me to do? Well, what I'm saying here is that when we begin to love ourselves, we stop devaluing ourself. We stop devaluing the inner self. We stop devaluing the inner soul, right? Because that's what truly matters. And I like to give an example of how that soul kind of reminds me of a higher self. And I found that when we allow ourselves, when we allow the higher self to be, we begin to realize that our value is not based on our looks. It's not based on the way we dress. It's not based on the size of our breasts. For men, the size of whatever. You know, think about it. It's not based on the fact that you're a woman and wear a size 10 shoe, which you can't stand and you feel like your feet look like boats. I mean, really? Is that really the truth? And why do we devalue ourselves based on the looks in our society? And so we got to overcome that first step. Because I've realized that when we place judgment upon the way we look and we value ourselves based on those looks, we lose out on what truly matters. We lose out on the reason for us being here. Because we're too busy putting limitations on what's good, what's valuable, and what's considered beautiful. So I ask you at this point in time to recognize the times in your life, if it's happening right now or what it's about when you're dealing with not valuing yourself, finding problems with yourself, being angry with things that happened or didn't happen, and being upset with the way possibly we look and how that generates. The second way that we devalue ourselves in this planet, in this world, is by our intellect. If we don't feel like we're intellectual enough, not smart enough, haven't had as much education. Again, these things should not be a part of the value that we have for ourselves. And I know we can all fall trap. Like sometimes when I'm listening to folks talk, I go, if I only had a doctorate, I could have this and I could have that, and people couldn't argue with me. But you know, it's like, it's always something else. It's never enough. Once you had a doctorate, you need two doctorates, right? Once you have another doctorate, you need a third doctorate. It's kind of like the money quotient is you have, folks, you know, how much money would you need to be comfortable? And people say, you know, three times more than I have right now. And it's like we're never happy with what we have, and we're never what? Grateful for what we have. And I find that when we realize and begin to love ourselves past what we don't have, past the issues with our looks, past the issues with our intellect, past the issues with our money, we're not as financially strong as someone else. And I've dealt with that too, where you look at somebody that has all this money and power and you judge yourself based on that. But again, we're judging ourselves on the exterior, whether it's exterior money or intelligence or looks. It's the exterior value. You know, it's like judging the home on the aluminum siding. And so I ask you right now to begin to allow those things to go by the wayside and begin to be grateful for what you truly are. And it took me a while based on my situation. I was born with a condition I didn't understand. There was no definition. There was no diagnosis. All I knew is I felt bad a lot, and I didn't look like everybody else because some people would consider me having some sort of being deformed into some way. And now that when I say that word, I'm just like, oh, what an yucky word. It's like defining yourself based on a disease. Instead of calling it a disease, what if we called it a dis-ease? Your body at this time is not at ease. Let's figure out how to make things work. And so I feel that if we can, if I was able to overcome that and go through those processes, not knowing what I had, being judged by other kids, being judged by, you know, even my father not accepting the fact of what I was dealing with. Think about all that stuff. And I know that you've gone through things just like this. Just like this. But it's time to let the things that we're holding on to that are holding us back, it's time to let them go. If no good can come out of what you're holding on to, you've got to put it down and let it go. Life on this planet right now is for you to be that soul, to be that heart, to be that love, to be the spirit that encourages yourself, but just radiates love and encourages to others. You know, and I ask you right now to begin to really do kind of just like a self-analysis of where you are in your life and where you want to be. You know, the first thing is, are you where you want to be? Have you figured out some sort of purpose or direction? But also to allow things to be. I think oftentimes, because of the way we were brought up, we make judgment calls on everything. We assume certain things are real, certain things are not real. And I ask you to begin to realize that it's time for you to create your own life perspective. That's why this show is called Live Your True Life Perspectives, because I wrote books titled Live Your True Life because I figured out how to begin to roll down that path of living your true life. Okay, not your perfect life, not your best life, but your true life. And truth supersedes all those things. Because our honest truth, our personal truth, is so unique and so powerful and filled with so much love that when you tap into that truth, you realize the power you have within. You realize your connection to the source. You realize your place and your part in this matter. It's huge. And I know sometimes we can feel small, but we are really not small. We have the ability to impact every single person around us. We have the ability to impact everything. And we can either choose to impact that for the positive, choose to impact that for the negative, or choose to do nothing at all. It's time to figure out what we need to do next. And I thought it was interesting talking to Roy because, you know, 15 million people with near-death experiences that have connected to the God source can't be wrong. I don't need that much proof. If you need proof, then 15 million is that's a lot of proof. I think that's past proof. I think we've already figured out doctrine and truth. But if you do need it, you know, reading Roy's book could help you. Could help you, you know, really take a chance and really figure out where in your life can you impact people. But also, where in your life are you holding yourself back from loving yourself? Because I found that everything that we can see within others, we have to see within ourselves first. Everything that we see within others, we have to see within ourselves first. And once we do that, then everything miraculously opens up. Remember to really use your time wisely. Like Roy was saying, you know, you're not at the end of this lifetime, you're not going to go up there and go, well, you know what? I saw every episode of XYZ and I watched 22 hours of Netflix every day and I'm here. No, I mean, it's fine to watch occasional TV and a show, but realize that you have the ability to make a great impact. Your life is a feature epic film. And that epic film gets more interesting when the character lives their life to create love for themselves and to create unconditional love for other people and learning why we're here and experiencing it and just making a massive, massive, amazing, successful dive into this life, because that's why we're here. And in the meantime, have fun on this earthly plane. Have fun. Go swimming. Go dancing. Sing in the shower. Be who you are. Be unique. Be in nature. Love. Roll in the dirt. Like, you know, roll in the grass. Go sledding. Do karaoke. This is part of why you're here. But in the process, realize the bigger picture. And to me, that bigger picture is so amazing and so cool. I think the cool kids are doing it. Stay tuned. I got a great show for you next. And remember to live your true life, to live your true life on a daily basis. And when things don't seem right or unstable, take a second to step back and realize, is there negative content in your mind? Is there negative self-talk that you've created that is holding yourself back? And are you holding on to any anger or fear that you can work through, begin to work through and let go to really claim the prize that is this life? Stay tuned. Live Your True Life Perspectives with your host, me, Ashley Burgess. First off, hold on, I almost didn't do it. Go check out the show on Spreaker, Stitcher, Google Play. Live Your True Life Perspectives has their own iHeart station. You can hear us 7 days a week on the radio. Go to Facebook, Ashley.Burgess. Go to Facebook and follow the show, Live Your True Life Perspectives with Ashley Burgess, because I want to hear from you. And stay tuned, because Live Your True Life Perspectives with me, Ashley Burgess, will be back this time. You know what? I'll be back this time in three shakes.